Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening once again. This is Queensbury Rules Radio, and I'm Patrick Connor of Queensbury Rules. Also on the line here, I have James Foley of Bad Left Hook. James, how goes it? Hello? Well, I guess I don't have James on the line, but I'm sure he'll be calling in any moment, or perhaps he has me on mute or something like that. But today we have a fun show for you guys once again. We're going to have Jimmy Tobin of Cruelest Sport on, and we're also going to be having Alex McClintock, also of Queensbury Rules Radio, on. So basically, I think it's safe to say that Gennady Golovkin has all but set the boxing world on fire with his punching power. Maybe that's a little bit of hyperbole, and I'm not really sure what the ratings were for this past Saturday's show, but I can only imagine that they were good, at least for boxing ratings, because Gennady Golovkin is a guy that has gotten some pretty decent shine among, you know, hardcore boxing enthusiasts over the last year or so. And needless to say, he punches hard, and it's fairly apparent. So it should be, you know, pretty decent and pretty exciting to see how he comes up in the world of boxing in the next few years. So basically what I'm hearing from Sergio Martinez's camp and Ludabella is that Sergio Martinez is injured, and, you know, he hasn't had knee surgery yet, but expects to be having it somewhat soon, but also doesn't really expect to return to the ring until next year. So that's kind of a mythical matchup for now, and it's a dream matchup that a lot of boxing fans are looking forward to. Let me see. It seems as though James is on the line. James, are you there? Weird. In any event, so I guess I will start out by talking about the Gennady Golovkin-Matthew Macklin fight. Most people watched it. They're pretty familiar with what happened at this point. It was Gennady Golovkin walking down a credible middleweight who has, you know, gone somewhat close with a bunch of other top middleweights, namely Felix Sturm, who many felt he deserved to win against about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and also Sergio Martinez, who he was stopped by late in the fight, but was giving trouble to very clearly. And so I think that it's fair to say that Matthew Macklin has proved himself to be a credible middleweight, and maybe not a superstar by any means, and also not necessarily super elite. But at the same time, oh, you know what? I'm sorry. Give me one moment. That is weird. Okay. Let me see if I can patch James through once more. James, you there?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, there you are.
Oh, great. Sorry. Can you hear me?
Sorry about that, everybody. Well,
hey, you got our man, Alex McClintock? Can you hear him?
Can you hear me?
Yes. I hear you.
Excellent.
Brilliant.
So let me see here.
All right,
maybe I did something wrong in the little host queue or whatever, but in any event, I'd already started kind of, you know, recapping Golovkin-Macklin, but please continue. James. That's odd. Maybe something is going weird with the microphones or something like that. But James, can you hear me?
Yeah. I can hear you perfectly fine.
Huh. That's weird. Something weird going on with Blog Talk. But
okay. Am I coming through?
Yeah, you're coming through. All I was saying was that I had kind of already started digging in. All right. I started digging into Golovkin-Macklin from the other day, but please continue.
I actually missed what your opening comment was.
I was just saying that Gennady Golovkin is a hard hitter, needless to say, and that he took out a pretty credible middleweight the other day, and, you know, in a fairly surprising fashion. And I hadn't really gotten much farther than that. Couldn't really get much farther on my own. So
yeah,
I wanted you to start rolling through that.
Well, you have to be impressed with it. You know, he just broke the guy in half with one punch. And I think now we've got real evidence that Golovkin is certainly among the top two middleweights in the world. And at this point, Sergio's there more just on legacy than anything else and what he's done the last few years, because that matchup looks pretty terrifying for Martinez at the moment with all of his injury problems and the damage that he's taken in his last couple fights. But you know, it gets you really excited thinking about all the great matchups that could be ahead for a guy like Golovkin, especially with the backing of HBO. And, you know, a lot of people have talked about the next Manny Pacquiao, you know, the foreign fighter who's going to come over here to really achieve his fame and riches. Are there any opponents out there that can propel Golovkin to that level that you guys could realistically see him being put in with in the next, you know, couple years?
I can't realistically see anyone put up their hand to go in there with Golovkin in the next couple of years after that. It's going to be really hard for him to find willing opponents, isn't it?
Well, you know, a lot of the talk, at least from what I've seen, in the wake of the fight is basically just that, you know, the one of the bigger matchups, maybe not so much in terms of name power, but outside of a Martinez matchup would be Peter Quillen and Gennady Golovkin. And personally, I mean, I don't really see why that fight necessarily can't be made. I know that there's the network stuff and like the promoter stuff and all that type of bullshit, but at the same time, I'm personally not aware of K2 Promotions who Golovkin is with having any type of beef with any other like promoter or network. And yeah, that's a fight I'd like to see, and that would just basically cement Gennady Golovkin's claim to being next in line for Martinez.
Yeah, I think the two big fights that you're going to see kind of being pushed for is Golovkin and Martinez, which at this point, I don't really care if it never happens, because I feel like Martinez is clearly past his best. I don't think there's anything he can really do to come back and prove that he's not, you know. Maybe if Martinez rematches Chavez and just gets through the entire fight without, you know, taking any damage and looks spectacular again, maybe a Golovkin fight becomes viable. But I just think you have to believe, with all of his injuries and having been pretty badly hurt, certainly really badly hurt against Chavez and kind of dinged up a bit against Murray, you know, you have to think that Sergio's on the decline as a 38-year-old guy and with knee injuries and everything else and hand injuries. You're never going to see the best Martinez against the best Golovkin. So I don't need to see that just to have some kind of ritualistic torch passing. I think the other fight that they're going to try to push for, HBO that is Golovkin against Andre Ward at some point. And that might take a while to develop. But to me, you know, unless Ward jumps up to 175, and he doesn't seem like he's really been in a hurry to do that, I think that's the natural fight that's going to happen. It's just a matter of building it to where it's big enough to kind of make it as special as it could be. But if both of those guys continue on, and if you know, Ward can fight Frock again, or if one of those guys can get in there with Chavez Jr. and get that win and get, you know, the exposure from that, I think Golovkin-Ward is going to be a real super fight somewhere down the line.
You don't think Ward's too big for Golovkin?
Well, I think it's going to be a problem for him in that fight, yeah. But as long as there's still one weight division apart and Golovkin seems willing to do it, I don't see why it wouldn't happen. I don't think Golovkin's going to avoid that fight. I mean, Ward's too big in terms of it being actually being competitive? You know, I don't know. I mean, the guy just knocked out a solid middleweight. So I think he's got power to hurt guys.
And Matthew Macklin, I mean, you know, don't get me wrong, because he's not a huge middleweight, but he's certainly not a small middleweight. And Golovkin looked to be a pretty good size compared to him. So, I mean, don't get me wrong. I do think that there is a fairly clear, you know, size gap between Golovkin and Ward. You know, and in boxing, 8 pounds is significant. But at the same time, you know, I don't know that Golovkin would be a tiny guy at 168 pounds. And it certainly seems to me like he has the type of heavy hands that would help his power carry up.
And he has said he's willing to fight that. So I guess that's a plus.
Well, at the end of the day, I think that you want, if there's going to be a new champion or a new type of, you know, star or whatever on the scene, you want there to be kind of an official torch passing rather than kind of a just consensus, you know, this guy is the best, you know, whispering about. But, you know, I'm personally, like, I think that it was earlier this morning, it was either late last night or earlier this morning, that I saw a report from Sergio Martinez's camp that he hasn't had knee surgery yet, but he will need knee surgery, and that, you know, he's probably not going to be returning until, like, something like March 2014. So, I mean, I know that as you get older, your body breaks down, takes longer to heal, et cetera, et cetera, but I don't even really see the benefit. You know, having had knee surgery myself, I don't really see the benefit in waiting potentially months to have the surgery and then only coming back, you know, like 9 months later or something like that. It seems a little bit much to me.
I don't know what's going on with that, but, you know, the way things have been going for him, as much damage as he's been taking in his last couple fights, you know, you have to imagine, even if he does come, he's not going to come back and then immediately jump in there with Golovkin after, you know, a year out of the ring and coming off a shaky performance against Murray. And even if he fights somebody like Rubio, like a Marco Antonio Rubio, the way Sergio looked against Murray, he's going to take punishment in that fight too, you know. So that, then how much longer is he going to be out? So, you know, if it ever does happen, I mean, maybe he could just, you know, stay away until like late next year, and then just try to come back for one huge fight and fight against Golovkin, if that's the case. But, you know, I just don't see him really being able to get in a position to kind of convince us that it's going to be competitive. I think that Chavez fight took, you know, so much out of him. And we saw the evidence of that against Murray. And, I'm kind of with you. I mean, I like the ritual of the official passing of the torch, and that if Golovkin beats Sergio, he's a legitimate middleweight champion and we don't have to get into all that nonsense again. I like that too. But, you know, in this situation, when I think it's just going to be more symbolic than actually like a meaningful fight, I mean, I don't really have a problem with Sergio just bowing out. Maybe he takes, maybe Sergio takes a Chavez rematch, which is a huge money fight, and what if he loses that, and then Chavez is suddenly the legitimate middleweight champ?
I think that's a dream scenario for Golovkin.
Yeah, and then Golovkin can be the guy that Chavez is ducking, and pressure will mount for that to happen. You know, and that would be a great fight. But
I reckon that's a dream scenario because Chavez has the fan base that Martinez doesn't.
Yeah.
Martinez, for all the work that Lou DiBella put in, never developed an American fan base. All those pay-per-view buys against Chavez, that was all about Chavez. If Golovkin gets to fight Chavez eventually, who knows, maybe it'll take 2-3 years. But then that's the best scenario for him, because he gets more eyeballs on him when he eventually wins it. And I don't think there's anyone out there who would pick Chavez against Golovkin.
I mean, I think that there are a handful of fights at or around 160, 168 pounds. Even a couple at 154 pounds for Golovkin that are just kind of like, you know, they're just kind of dream matchup type fights, you know, even against Carl Froch, even if it's not against Andre Ward, but just Carl Froch, you know, even a Mikael Kessler fight, you know, those type of fights for me are the type of fights where, you know, the opponent, quote unquote, of Golovkin is going to be a guy who can take a punch, give one back, and has kind of a warrior mentality more often than not. You know, Chavez is included in that group. And so, you know, these are all the type of fights that I want to see, and whether or not Golovkin's going to knock these guys out. And, you know, I think that there's a decent chance that he could storm into these types of fights and come out, you know, winning by stoppage, regardless.
Yeah.
The journey
I would love to see him fight Chavez or Froch, and those would both be huge fights. You know, those are the perfect kind of opponents for him. I mean, as much as, you know, we have to give him a lot of credit for what he did to Macklin, but Macklin's not invulnerable like those guys are. Macklin's been stopped before. You know, Macklin, so it was such a great one-punch And Macklin's a really solid guy, and you have to give him a ton of credit for that. But it's not like he really cracked an iron chin, and that would be something special. You know, if he was able to knock out Carl Froch or Chavez Jr., both of those guys who could just take unbelievable beatings, Chavez Jr. might have a better chin than Froch. But they're both, they've, you know, both have granite. So those are the kind of fights that Golovkin knocks one of those guys out, and they're both really popular, so you'd have a lot of eyeballs on that. You know, that's going to push him huge. That's the thing, is with Andre Ward, it'd be a great dream fight for boxing fans, but right now it's not really that big of a fight in terms of business.
What do you guys think?
Yeah,
is it
Andre Ward.
Possible for Golovkin to be another Pacquiao? Because he doesn't have that. He doesn't have the Filipino fan base. There's no big Kazakh minority in America, as far as I'm aware of. Do you think he can become that big of a crossover?
I think that for right now, that's probably a little bit premature. But at the same time, you know, he does seem to have a good amount of buzz going around his name, at least in the kind of, you know, hardcore boxing community. Maybe the numbers from this past weekend have already come out, and I haven't seen them. That's definitely possible, but you know, I can't imagine that they did great numbers. And in the past, I don't think that his fights have done that great numbers, you know, either. But there's wiggle room for improvement there for sure. And if he keeps knocking guys out, or at least, you know, maybe not these type of clean Macklin knockouts, but even just beating the crap out of guys like Gabe Rosado and stopping them, you know, that's eye-catching, and that's something that not only hardcore fans can relate to and want to see, but it's something casual fans want to see too. Whether or not he can propel himself into like a superstar status, you know, that really, really remains to be seen.
Yeah, I just want to say I think it's highly unlikely, that he would ever get to where Pacquiao is, because Pacquiao had just such a perfect storm of, like you pointed out, the really rabid ethnic fan base, and he had the opportunities against really popular Mexican fighters, Barrera, Morales, Marquez, before he really made that jump when he got the chance to fight De La Hoya. So it was like, and when he started fighting those guys, I mean, he was probably like 24, 25. So it you know, he didn't become the sensation that he is overnight, and it really all kind of, you know, like escalated incredibly after the De La Hoya fight, you know. But and that's the problem with Golovkin. He's kind of just coming on our radars now. He's already 31. Does he have those kind of opponents where he can, you know, become even as popular as Manny was before the De La Hoya fight, and then to have a superstar like that you can really launch into the, you know. But, you know, you're talking about one of the two most popular fighters of the last decade, one of the most popular fighters really of the last, you know, 50 years. So he can definitely, I think, get a lot of buzz and get a lot of word of mouth and end up having a nice career, because people love that kind of a fighter, you know, and he is just a monster. But it'd be unlikely for him to. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say that I had seen Jimmy Tobin waiting on the line there for a minute, but
oh, shit.
I didn't realize that was his number, because I forgot he was calling in from Skype. So he's on the line with us now. Jimmy.
Hey, gentlemen.
How's it going,
Tobin?
Man? How are you?
Hey,
Tobin,
how you
good?
Going, man?
Good. I'm trying this from my iPad, and I'm technically now logically challenged, so hopefully this just plays out properly, and you can hear me better than last time when I was muffled and speaking into my sleeve, it sounded like.
It's much better already.
Good. I'm glad.
So,
We screwed up and we went like two episodes without proclaiming Tobin the greatest boxing writer, living or dead. So,
oh, yeah, those are the easiest episodes for me to listen to.
We thought we'd have to get him back on the show to plead his case.
Yeah, never hear that argument from me, my friend.
There are rumors going around that Jimmy Tobin is going to be building 90-seat bleachers in the parking lot of Caesar's Palace for Floyd Canelo. It's just a rumor so far, though. It's a Vegas thing.
Oh, yeah. I love, like, you know, press conferences and regurgitated information delivered to people who actually want to hear it. I don't really get it. I can't understand it for the life of me, but they're doing a really good job at that stuff, I guess. But all you guys are fucking crazy. Well, Golovkin is the greatest thing ever and is going to go down as the greatest person to ever put leather on his body when it's all said and done.
Well, let me ask you a more serious question about Gennady Golovkin.
Yeah.
If, you know, considering his punching power and how he basically badassed his way through the fight through Matthew Macklin, exactly how many metric fuck tons must his testicle sack hold?
I mean, how do you measure that? How do you, like, on the Richter scale, or I wouldn't even know how to measure something like that.
I think it's a Fukushima thing, you know, the tornado scale. And he's rating an F5.
Like, if he ever stood up really quickly, there would be a tidal wave somewhere.
Yeah, he'd lose blood in his head, that's for sure. So what did you tell us a little bit about that fight, you know, give us your take.
Well, like, I figured that he would beat Macklin, because, I mean, Macklin was there to lose, right? That's what they picked up. That was kind of perfect matchmaking. It's the guy with the name coming off a knockout on a pay-per-view, I think, if I remember correctly. So, like, a little bit of hype, or not hype, but at least the last impression of him was of Macklin being pretty destructive. And the one before that was of him going 11 rounds with Martinez. However effective he was there, that's debatable. Maybe the duration of the fight is a little misleading. Like James said, like, he broke the guy in half with one punch. That's always impressive. But what was really impressive to me was that everything he hits you with hurts. Like, the jab hurts. He jabbed a couple times in the first round, and Macklin was not comfortable anymore. You know, like, the stuff that hits the gloves, the stuff that you try and parry hurts. The stuff that you try and absorb on your arms or whatever, all of that stuff hurts. And a lot of people can punch. You know, Randall Bailey can punch, and you know, Samuel Peter could punch at heavyweight, and there are people who can punch, but, like, the package that he uses to deliver that is really what makes him impressive, or what has the potential to make him special if a certain number of factors fall into place. Like, I'm smitten because he's fun to watch, and we don't always get things that are fun to watch, you know, maybe, you know, less than half the time. But that kind of stuff, you know, I'm maybe a little hyperbolic in my praise or excitement about it. But only jokingly so. Really, he's, you know, one of the most interesting and compelling figures in the sport right now. I would say him and Matisse are the two guys that you kind of get really excited about. Where are they going to go? What could they do?
You're smitten with his impressive package.
Yes.
All right.
You can't really imagine Golovkin in a bad fight, can you? Even that Ward fight we were talking about, like, Andre Ward is not the most popular fighter in terms of, like, he's defensively minded, he mauls, he pushes, he uses his head. But even that fight kind of sounds like it has the potential to be really, really fun. Can you guys imagine a situation where Golovkin was in a bad fight?
Hopkins, maybe. But
yeah, I mean, there are some styles that I think could probably neutralize what he does, but, you know, kind of like how James, or how Jimmy was saying that, you know, I've seen a handful of comments and, you know, kind of like YouTube-type comments and, like, you know, baiting-type comments on Twitter, on Facebook in the last few days, basically saying, I don't see anything special in Golovkin. You know, he's got punching power and that's it. But, I mean, I have to question what they're watching then, because, yeah, he's got punching power and that's pretty clear, but he also has a really good sense of distance. And there were only a handful of clinches in the fight, even though Macklin was kind of trying to neutralize him that way, because Golovkin was really, like, he was pulling his gloves out, and he's doing exactly what a fighter should be doing when they don't want to be clinched. You know, and I hate to, like, you know, really, you know, praise Teddy Atlas a ton, because some, you know, he gets kind of pedantic and, you know, he does the same type of repetitive, you know, little cliches or whatever. But at the same time, when he says that, you know, guys are clinching because it takes two to tangle, it's true. You know, one guy has to be at least somewhat complicit in it, and he, in Golovkin, is not. You know, he does a lot of things really right, and it's not just the power.
Yeah,
well,
he's like, he sets all of that stuff up, and like you're saying, his distance is so good. Like, he's out of range, and then he kind of moves into it, and once he's in range to hit you, you're kind of, like, so far, it seems that that's kind of it for you. Like, you aren't going to be able to handle what he's giving you, no matter what you fire back. So guys are always trying to clinch him. But then, you know, he cuts the ring off so well that, I mean, Macklin was on his bike by the second round. And Golovkin just kind of steps here purposefully, steps there purposefully, and he's on you. And once he's on you, the only thing you can really do is try and hold on to him. But it was Macklin, right? Like, let's be honest, but, I mean,
well, we've also never seen Macklin really fight that way. We've never really seen Macklin fight that way before. I mean, you know, like he was kind of like moving, and he was moving and being funky against Martinez, but he was still engaging quite a bit. Like, he was kind of going in and out, like he was, you know, more in control against Golovkin. It was like, holy shit, get me away.
Yeah, and I have to say, I mean, I'm not trying to take anything away from Golovkin, but Macklin looked terrible. I mean, like, he I don't know how what he was thinking, if he thought that style was going to give him any chance to win the fight, just right from the get-go. And, you know, maybe Golovkin just hit him a couple times and immediately changed his entire mindset. But Macklin just seemed like he was just in desperation mode so early in that fight and never seemed confident to try to really get anything going. So, you know, maybe it's just a testament. But, Alex, like you were saying last week about, do you think that Macklin's going to be intimidated in the big moments? And I was like, no, I don't think so. I mean, he fought Sergio when Sergio was, you know, still like an elite guy. But he really just seemed out of his element from the get-go.
But I think you were right still. I don't think he was intimidated before the fight. I think it was once he felt what Golovkin had, which was kind of interesting to see, because there was about a minute there where I felt like he looked okay, and then he, you know, he caught a few punches, and he suddenly didn't look like, his face went gray, and then it went red.
Oh, yeah.
And he didn't want to be there.
Well, he let Golovkin just stalk him so methodically, and he never once tried to meet him at center ring and impose any of his own offense on him and just let him know you're in there with a real middleweight. He never did that, and I don't know how he could have thought that he could win that fight, you know, backpedaling and throwing it, flicking a jab out. It just, I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, yeah, it takes courage to jump in and try to brawl with a huge puncher, but, you know, it's either that or just a master boxer that's going to be required to, you know, dismantle Golovkin's offense, and Macklin was unwilling to do the first. Obviously, he's not a master boxer.
No. And in the post-fight, he had mentioned something about wanting to take advantage of, you know, the advantages of his experience versus Golovkin's relative inexperience. And I assume that meant going into the later rounds, and that's fine. You know, there are guys who could probably do that. And I think a healthy Martinez, even in this kind of reduced capacity, if his legs are good, he'll be able to maybe pose that question a little bit better than Macklin. But I mean, Golovkin's been 10 rounds once. And, like, you just can't assume that you're going to be able to take him into later rounds because nobody gets that far. And,
yeah,
you know, Macklin's been the most durable guy. Yeah, it's wishful thinking. It's kind of crazy to think, you know, like, Macklin's been knocked out before. Jamie Moore knocked Macklin face down out, you know. Like, the one thing we knew about Golovkin was that the power was legit. Yeah. So I don't know that, you know, that strategy was going to serve him very well. But ultimately, he's just not as good. So he wasn't going to get over in that fight.
And the other thing is, you know, Macklin didn't take Martinez's punch as well either, prior to the round that ended up knocking him out, you know. So I'm probably guilty, too, of kind of mischaracterizing this going into the fight as Macklin being this kind of sturdy guy because, really, you know, yeah, he had a tough fight against Felix Sturm, who's not really a big puncher, but he has been knocked out before. And so maybe, you know, I think it was a pretty easy pick, which I think we all picked, was that Golovkin would end up knocking him out. But, you know, you would have just expected some, I guess, more resistance from somebody who – you know, I think Macklin's got a great attitude for a fighter. I think he really, you know, his mind probably was in the right place going into this. But, like, once he got in the ring, he just, you know, he was discouraged so quickly from doing anything but kind of just letting himself be walked down and turning himself into this prey for Golovkin. And Jimmy, interesting that you mentioned some of the kind of analysis of the Martinez fight, because I'm in the camp that I didn't think Macklin was terribly competitive beyond the fourth or fifth round. I thought he maybe was able to win a couple of closer, quieter rounds early on, but I didn't see that being a close fight at all. I thought Martinez ended up just taking over, going into another gear, and just punishing him for the last six rounds of that fight before he ended up knocking him down twice and stopping him.
Yeah, once Macklin gassed, he's going to start to quit on him, because it does. Martinez took total control of that fight. And Martinez isn't the kind of, you know, not the same style of fighter as Golovkin. So with that kind of in-out thing, he's just going to, he'll pot shot early, you know, and kind of ramp it up a little bit later. But I don't, that fight wasn't close. It just went 11 rounds, which was perhaps notable. You know, it was close to the first time I watched it, and I was excited. Then going back and looking at it again, That was a pretty easy win for Martinez.
Yeah, I mean, he really didn't win a round late in the, you know, in the last, like, seven rounds of that fight, other than kind of the fluky knockdown that he got, and I guess he would have given him a 10-8 just for that, but it wasn't even, like, really a clean knockdown. It was kind of another Martinez balance knockdown, which seems to happen to him in every fight.
Mm-hmm. But that's what guys at that level are supposed to do. Like, Macklin isn't supposed to be competitive with guys at that level. So I think the fact that he got, you know, he lasted as long as Ishida kind of tells you that Golovkin is like you said, second, probably one of the two best middleweights in the division. That's probably where he is. He doesn't really have to prove that kind of membership anymore.
Well, it's a good thing we didn't start the "This Ain't Ishida" hashtag, because actually it pretty much was Ishida as far as Golovkin was concerned.
Well, I was actually going to get on to the rest of the card, but before I do, I also wanted to mention something very quickly. there was a lightweight contender named Gary Belletto, who fought a couple times on Friday Night Fights, maybe, and I would say about 2004 or so, maybe a little bit before that, 2002. Regardless, Mr. Henry Haskup, who is a ring announcer and also a historian from New Jersey, he had posted in a Facebook group that I'm in earlier today that Gary Belletto had suffered a trampoline accident, actually. And no, I'm not kidding. He did suffer a trampoline accident, and he broke his neck or fractured something in his neck, and he's now in critical condition in a Rhode Island hospital. So I just wanted to mention that really quick, and tell you guys to head over to his Facebook account. It's G Belletto, two L's, two T's, and you know, throw some words of encouragement his way if you could. That said, getting into the undercard of Golovkin Macklin, Thomas Wiestesen kind of, I put in air quotes, earned a draw against Brandon Gonzalez. That was the next fight down on the broadcast, and I don't know. I'm not very convinced either way. Although I did think that Brandon Gonzalez looked better overall. I did think that there were a couple points in the fight where Brandon Gonzalez looked to be in control and kind of let Wiestesen in the fight a little bit. But I think the story of the fight was clearly that Wiestesen was looked at as the guy who should have won, and Brandon Gonzalez came in and surprised a lot of people with some good hand speed, good movement, solid ability, and against a guy that's, you know, kind of awkward to fight because he's so tall and so long. So, I mean, and before I get your guys' opinion, also I have to ask real quick, Virgil Hunter was in Brandon Gonzalez's corner, and he was, like, whispering sweet nothings to Brandon Gonzalez between rounds in a really, really creepy way in the later rounds. So how creepy is that? On a scale of, I don't know, 1 to 10, 1 being not creepy at all, 5 being, you know, the voice that comes from a speaking spell, where are we?
I feel, you know, that creeped me out. or at least it was entertaining. I mean, that guy, you know, Hunter does a lot of talking, and I never really noticed it come out in that tone before. But it's hard to take it seriously. Like, everyone was cracking jokes about it the entire time. Now imagine, you know, this guy's training you to punch people in the head and take punches in the head, and how you kind of process. I don't know. I mean, it's kind of trivial, but it is pretty funny that this dude has this kind of silky smooth pimp voice. He's, you know, ushering these fellows into the middle of the ring to bash each other in the head. He's a
there's solid comic funny. Relief from the corners in both undercard fights.
Yeah. Or the conversations between Hunter and Amir Khan. How awesome are those?
I'd like to see the conversation between Hunter and Jack Lowe, kind of polar opposites on the
Yeah, it would be kind of nice to have, like, you know, what if you had one of those kind of, like, star trainer teams where, like, multiple trainers team up to train one guy, and it's like on one side you have Virgil Hunter, on the other side you have Teddy Atlas. Like, go win the fight. Go win the fight. You're doing great. Come on, get out there. Your kids are watching. Come on. Your kids are watching. Go win the fight. You know.
Someone needs to make a soundboard of all the top trainers.
Well, you got to get Andre Berto's brother in there, too.
Yeah.
Be an assassin.
The Jack Lowe soundboard only has one button. Double the jab. Double the jab.
Well, you need a fuck button, too.
Yeah.
Fuck. Is that the Chuck Ciampa button?
When he dropped the F-bomb with the Keller during the Kellerman interview. I mean, those are, to me, that's like one of the dumbest things that HBO has done, is sending Kellerman to interview the trainers, like, during the rounds. But that was clearly the highlight of that series so far.
Yeah, I don't know why they do that. I don't know what purpose that serves. I don't, like, he should be doing this, or the fighter should be doing this, or he should be doing this. But we know that because we get to see what's going on in the corner in between rounds.
Plenty.
Well, you know what? It's kind of like, I guess, I don't know if it's a flawed analogy, and not to bring up pretty much the opposite sport of boxing, golf, but it's kind of like Tiger Woods getting, like, has gotten these rules violations when viewers watching on TV phone in to the PGA. And when I saw Kellerman, like, interviewing Robert Garcia during the Danair Rigondeaux fight, and he's telling Garcia, like, your fighter's way behind, basically, to me that seemed kind of like you might be influencing somebody. I mean, obviously Garcia's still watching the fight too, so he knows what's going on. But hearing an outside, you know, third party come over and basically tell him, hey, you know, is you going to tell your guy to turn it around here? Implication being, you know, you're down like 5-0, 5-0 at this point. You know, to me, that's almost like HBO kind of telling one corner, you know, giving one corner somewhat of an advantage in telling them kind of where they're at.
Yeah. And if anything, on those broadcasts, like, maybe not everybody feels this way, but they need to do less. I need less cameras going to different places in the arena. I need less interviews with people who aren't, you know, directly involved. I need, like, give me less of a presentation, and I need less, you know, bandstanding from the commentary team. I just, like, I'm not going to turn the sound off. I'm not like that. I need, you know, I like the sound of the crowd and all that stuff. I'm not going to turn that off. But
you only did that to watch the 7th round in Bradley.
Yeah, Pacquiao. I only did that for the 7th round at Pacquiao. Everything hinges on that. But you know what I mean? Like, I don't need you to give me anything beyond that. And I know that maybe I'm not indicative of the average person who has HBO, but I think I'm pretty close to what the average person who watches boxing on HBO is like. You know, so less of
less of everything, but I'd like to get some cams to follow around Buffer and Lampley after the fight for like 2 hours. Maybe you just put that online or something.
Yeah, but Gigolo's went to Showtime or whatever. It's not on HBO anymore.
Good call.
Well, I mean, like,
has anyone commented on the West Hazen Gonzalez fight yet?
No, but
because you know, I mean, I was impressed with Gonzalez's performance. To be honest, I've thought Tommy Gunn was decent in the past, you know, and he's got good size, and he seems like he has some some stuff going on, but Gonzalez really, I mean, yeah, he faded late, and the HBO crew maybe was going a little bit over the top, but I still thought Gonzalez clearly won the fight. I thought he just boxed him so well in the early, And I thought it was really impressive for him, and the thing about it is, like, my rooting interest was completely decided when they showed those promo pieces. I mean, this dude's like Austin Trout 2.0, you know, just like the perfect gentleman. And he has this, like, all, you know, this nice family man and great personality. And then Oosthuizen spends 5 minutes talking about how to pronounce his name, which I obviously didn't pay attention to. So, you know, I thought it was kind of a shame that this ended up in a draw. But, you know, I guess Gonzalez, you know, you get a rematch and then beat him more definitively this time. I mean, I think it was a good experience for him, and he looked really good. And, you know, the people I know who watched the fight all came away with a positive impression of him.
I agree.
I mean, that's
what I did as well.
Looking for, right? He gets on
for
TV,
sure.
He gets a chance to kind of earn a chance back, and I think that he did that. Commentary kind of, yeah, it was a little overblown at the end, but you know, it wasn't a bad fight. I think if Gonzalez, I don't know that he can get in better shape, but I do think tiring hurt him in the back stretch because he kept like bending at the waist to avoid punches, just bending forward to kind of slip the same punch, and Oosthuizen just lowered the target and hit him with it repeatedly in the second half of the fight. But maybe that was gas. Maybe he's, you know.
Or was he wiped out because he creamed his pants during Virgil's dirty talk?
Yeah, exactly.
And we don't know what happened, but it all kind of went downhill after that seventh round or whatever, that intermission between. But you know, it was a good performance, and I think pretty disastrous for Oosthuizen, because he was really on the rise and kind of, you know, cracking some top 10 lists in that division, and I think now he needs to go back and settle this. But it wouldn't surprise me if he just takes the draw and moves on, and he's still probably got a bigger name between the two of them.
And
yeah.
And that's what a lot of it comes down to, unfortunately, because, you know, in the wake of the fight, Brandon Gonzalez is saying, I want a rematch, and I haven't really heard a whole lot from Oosthuizen saying, let's do it again. You know, I wouldn't surprise me, and it's probably in his best interest to just move along.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, Gonzalez let him win those last rounds, and it's kind of hard to make a case. I mean, I still thought he won, but it was a 10-rounder. I thought it was like 6-4. So, you know, when you fade late and you give the guy the last three rounds of the fight, it's kind of tough to insist, like, oh, you owe me a rematch. It was, you know, it was a robbery. But I think it'd be nice to see one.
Agreed.
But not necessarily on HBO.
No, I don't know that I need to fight again.
Yeah, exactly. It's that level of fight. It was from the
beginning. If they do it as part of another triple header or something, then that's one thing.
Sure.
But not,
yeah,
I wouldn't be up for, you know, wasting a slot, you know, against that. It wasn't that compelling. It was a decent fight, but not that compelling.
There's been worse fights on HBO. Namely, Willie Nelson versus David Greisman on the undercard.
that was pretty close.
Should we get into that fight?
The comparison, anyway.
Yeah, no, definitely. And one of my questions here was, you know, will a fighter that closely resembling Greisman ever appear again on HBO or any other network, for that matter? But all jokes aside about that, yeah, I mean, I think most of us expected Willie was going to have a lot easier time with Lucian Coelho than he did. But Coelho's a tough dude, you know, and he'd only ever lost before to Canelo and Chavez Jr. So,
and I think that I didn't see the Chavez Jr. fight, but when I look back at it on Boxrec, it was like a close split decision, which from when you beat like Chavez Jr. in 2009, a close split decision,
that's
probably
a good sign,
that he won, really.
Yeah.
So
he's a tough, I mean, I think he was a tough guy, and he, you know, took Nelson's best shots and came back and hurt him a couple times. But, you know, have we seen the top for Willie Nelson? Is he just not going to be a real, you know, first class contender
I think it comes down to what you said last week, James. He doesn't have an identity as a fighter. He's all over the shop. He doesn't know whether he wants to stand and slug. He doesn't know whether he wants to pot shot from the outside. He doesn't know whether he wants to get in there and mix it up. And you saw that in the fight. He just kind of was listless at times. Just didn't really know how he was going about his business.
Yeah, I think Patrick said that, but I'll take the credit for it.
Yeah, you're both smart guys.
Well, I think I brought it up, but you agreed. So I'm willing to share credit.
I gave it a nod of consent. I did.
Well, I'll take that. Anything that gets James Foley's consent, you know, that should have been
good. Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, you know, I think that it's a decent point that, you know, we saw Nelson doing, you know, trying to do a couple different things, like almost trying a couple different styles during the fight. You know, Cuello was being a cagey fighter that was kind of getting up in his face and, you know, forcing him into positioning that he didn't really like and stuff like that. And then, you know, he would kind of, like, fight back but then start to slide away. And then he was just kind of all over the place, it seemed, mentally in terms of deciding what he wanted to do.
But I think that some of it is Cuello's not a bad fighter.
Not
and
at
Nelson's
all.
Just not that great of a contender, and he never really has been. You know, he had a couple nice wins on Showbox, and he's got a cool name, but, you know, as recently as, like, 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, I mean, he was, like, the opener on, like, a three-fight Showbox. So he's not never been, like, a real top level, and, you know, he's trained by Jack Lowe, who everyone knows from Kelly Pavlik, but he's not never been a real top-level contender. I think he had a couple nice wins recently, but this, you know, maybe shouldn't have surprised us as much as it probably did. And I was surprised by it. I thought Nelson would beat this guy a lot easier.
Jimmy, what did you take from the fight?
I thought Nelson started well, and then as soon as Bryson started fighting back, he didn't know what to do. Like, his range was really bad. He was getting caught by right hand as he was backing out because of being hurt by punches on the inside. And just, he didn't keep his hands up properly. It just wasn't very good. And maybe he doesn't respond to, maybe he just can't take a shot very well. And when he gets hit, it kind of all goes to pieces for him. But he didn't look very good.
I think that,
I don't know.
He's got no punch resistance.
Yeah, it's just, it's not just the punch resistance. It's like some guys don't take a shot well, but they know how to deal with being hurt. You know what I mean? Or it seems to me.
Yeah, they don't
he
get busted
take
when
a shot well,
guy has
doesn't know how to
deal with
being hurt.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting too on those two fights. You both had two really tall guys for their division, who just like had no idea how to use it.
Right.
Like,
yeah, and I think that's where the Nelson-Paul Williams thing that they were harping on, or it seemed to me that they were harping on this, Willie Nelson is like Paul Williams, but, you know, was pretty good. And when he got inside, he knew what, like, he moved his hands at least. Nelson
Paul Williams
not
knew who he was.
Man.
He was
a
fucking maniac.
Yeah.
Whereas
he was a riot.
Yeah.
Well, the resemblance is really just physical resemblance in the way that they kind of look when they're standing in the ring. But, yeah, like you guys said, I mean, he's not Paul Williams. He's no Paul Williams.
No, and I don't know, like, I don't know what his connections are, but, and I don't know why how he made it onto the show. I don't know what made it a triple header, but, like, they should have just, like, couldn't they have just done two good fights as opposed to making it a triple header and then, like, giving us these two, like, Friday night fight-level fights? This is one of these things I don't get. Why, like, more is not better. And I know, Patrick, you've talked about this before on the show. Like, more is not necessarily better. I don't want to be indiscriminate and just take everything, every fight that can be offered to me. I didn't think very much of the first two fights. And I guess I can deal with it because I was so interested in the last one, but I don't know, man. Like,
Jimmy, this is why you were right behind Dan Rafael on the short list to replace Ross Greenberg last year.
Yeah, I guess
the job
so,
that eventually went to Ken Hirschman. But you know, you've got some great ideas.
I just
I agree.
I think about it all the time. Like, man, imagine if you were running HBO Boxing and you had that budget, how much awesome shit you would have on the air.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's all, they're all entrenched with, like, the promoter relationships, and they let these guys put the stuff on the undercards. I mean, I didn't think it was horrible. I've seen a lot worse. I thought the two fights were, like, reasonably entertaining enough, you know, but it's nobody that anybody who comes over, like, casual fans is ever going to remember.
No.
Well,
They'll remember Golovkin, but that's it. Oh, you mean, like,
It's an accidental headbutt, and that fight is over and around. Like, that whole card sucks at that point.
Yeah, I mean,
basically. I don't think there's any question that, you know, the draw or the, you know, the main attraction was Gennady Golovkin. And then a lot of people thought Macklin was going to put up a better fight than that or last longer than that, et cetera. But to me, going in on paper, I thought that the undercard fights were, you know, they certainly weren't like world-class stuff, but to me, I thought that they would be, you know, competitive fights that could be entertaining. You know, Willie Nelson scored a couple of, you know, nice knockouts in the past, obviously against lesser guys. But, you know, and then Thomas always says and he gets hit a lot, so I figured that that would be fun. But, you know, I do get your point about, you know, we don't need every fight. You know, just because we have the time and budget for four fights on a card doesn't mean we should do it. You know, but then again, we get something like Wealth TV, you know, playing the Brian Valoria versus Hernan Marquez card, where we had five or four fights, and all four of them were like brawls, you know, and the first two were guys we didn't even know, really. So, you know, I think that it works both ways, but they just need to have better, you know, sight and a better feel for what's going to be a good fight. And not just pander to whoever's got the fighters, you know?
Yeah, I don't understand why the networks don't put their foot down more with these guys. And obviously now Golden Boy has this relationship with Showtime, and they're basically, you know, it seems like almost the same entity, Showtime Boxing and Golden Boy Promotions. And, you know, you can't really complain about the product so far, although I think some people have kind of gone overboard. I mean, yeah, we had a nice, like, Matisse-Peterson fight, but fights like Danny Garcia-Zab Judah, and, if they do a sequel to that, and Broner Malignaggi, I mean, stuff like that's not great. You know, we got Maidana Lopez. That was a good fight, but you know, so far they've done a good job. I don't think they've done a great job, but I just don't know why these networks. I mean, they control all the money. You know, they put up the biggest percentage of what these guys actually make, and you know, HBO and Showtime both. It would be nice. I mean, they could completely dictate what fights we get to see by just refusing to buy things that aren't, you know, good enough. But they don't do it. It's just such an incestuous relationship.
What makes it worse is where are you going to go? If you're Golden Boy and you pitch them something that sucks, and Showtime says no, where are they going to go? They can't go to HBO.
There's nowhere they can go that'll give them even a tenth of what they'll get from other networks.
Yeah.
They would do independent shows, which they've already tried to do, and I think that they figured out the hard way that it's not that easy to do, and it's not that easy to do well.
Yeah, like those Arum, like the Pinoy Power pay-per-views that he was doing with Donaire and stuff like. Even he said that you kind of eat the cost on those in a lot of ways. But it was just, I don't know, I don't want to be like negative, but something I was thinking about when I was watching that. And maybe part of it is because I just really wanted to get to the main event because I'm a fanboy. I'm kind of grumpy about it. I would like a better undercard. I don't need more boxing. I need better fights on the undercard. You know, I don't know if we really got that because, like, I don't watch Friday Night Fights for a couple reasons, but one of them is it doesn't really matter to me. And I kind of felt that way about the undercard that we got on Saturday.
How are you going to fill out your index cards with all your, like, prospect reports?
Oh, yeah, I know. It's really hard for me to do. It's not something that
Well, since Jimmy's in such a good mood, I guess I'll just go ahead and sweep right on onto the next fight, which was Sergio Mora versus Broxah on Friday Night Fights, which I think you said you didn't watch, but
I watch Friday Night Fights, and it's awesome. But I don't watch it on TV. I would rather, you guys reading about it, it's hilarious. I know that Sergio Mora had a beard, and that he looked like an evil villain. Like,
that's
General
all you need
Zod
to know, man.
Yeah, that was that's about enough. That's about the gist of it. I brought it up really
quickly. He was a close second to Oosthuizen's dad's mustache for best facial hair of the weekend.
That was the Larry Bird stash? It's classic.
Yeah, that was nice. He just needed some Larry Bird shorts. That's all he needed. But, I brought up this fight really briefly last week because we kind of ran out of time, which, for our intents and purposes was probably better because not a lot of people like talking about Sergio Mora. But I thought that the fight was better, much better than I thought it would be. Certainly not scintillating. But, for a Friday night fight's main event that everybody thought was going to suck, I thought, it got the job done. And that's it. Nobody else has to say anything else.
Let me ask you a question. So maybe this is ridiculous, but Golovkin's going to fight in November on HBO. I don't want to see Sergio Mora on HBO, but if they said that he might take an interim fight. Now, I would like to see how he handles a guy who has some wheels. Does Mora still have the kind of wheels that would be entertaining or interesting for six rounds? Because he's kind of part of Corral, right?
Well, I think when we had asked earlier, is there a fighter or perhaps even a type of style that we haven't really seen Golovkin against or we don't really know how it would turn out? And, don't get me wrong, because I've never been a big Sergio Mora fan. I don't hate the guy, but he's just one of those fighters that has never really tickled my fancy. And, a number of his fights have wound up being just not very entertaining. But at the same time, what he does in the ring, it can be effective. And it is tough for a lot of guys to deal with. And so that I think that, if he is able to fight his way to that level, and it sounds like we're not going to get Golovkin Martinez anytime very soon, or Golovkin Ward. I'm not so sure that fight is all that close either. These are the type of fights that are kind of like trial by fire type of fights where guys are forced to face different styles. Guys who are willing to do different things in the ring, power, no power, a bunch of skills, not a lot of skills, etc. I think that is the type of way that, coming up the hard way, as they say, that could really endear him even more than he has been to all sorts of fans.
I mean, I don't know that that's really just beating another Friday Night Fights level opponent. I know that. I'm just curious to see how it would happen. And if that interim fight between his return to HBO isn't, it's going to be like independent or shown on the internet or taking place in Monaco again or something like that, where it's not really taking the budget away from something that I a service that I pay for, and he needs an opponent, that's kind of an interesting style, I suppose. He's not going to, and then he comes back and maybe fights Martin Murray or not Martin Murray, but, someone, the winner of Gail Barker or something like that, just as a kind of an interim guy, a different look. Maybe that's viable.
Well, and plus for people who really don't like Sergio Mora, and I know that there are a handful out there, I think that I didn't know, I had to, when I was looking all this stuff up, I think that they'd said that Sergio Mora was 36. So he's not young, and the style that he has is the type of style where it's going to kind of lose its luster really quickly at some point. And so, for people who really don't like him, putting him in with Golovkin maybe 6 months from now might be the end of Sergio Mora's career for all intents and purposes.
Meh.
This is all a little bit sick for me. I don't know if I really buy it. This is like a ritual sacrifice on the top of a pyramid for me. I don't really like Sergio Mora, but I don't know if I hate him enough to throw him in with Gennady Golovkin. I get what you're saying, though, Jimmy, with the different style. I do get that, but I'd rather see him do it with, someone who isn't shit boring.
Yeah. Fair enough. I mean,
I don't know. I mean, I've never really, like, I've always in some ways liked Sergio Mora. You know, I just have always thought that kind of negative style of boxing is interesting. It can definitely be excruciating to watch at its worst. But, you know, I thought the Mora Mosley fight in some weird, like, way was kind of interesting just as an examination, you know. And maybe it would be kind of fun to see Mora try to just stink out the joint against Golovkin. I mean, I don't know, you know, it's hard to imagine he'd be able to do that very long. But, you know, I think you could do worse as far as if he's going to take a fight in 2 months or whatever, you know. The opponent's probably not going to be very good. So I'd rather see somebody we've heard of and we know and that would at least go in there with a game plan, you know, than just some guy who's just set him up for another spectacular knockout.
That's better than Ishida. I mean, and if he's going to be fighting 4 times a year, which he says, and I believe him because he doesn't seem to take a lot of damage, then, yeah, whatever. You know, if he's going to be fighting in 2 or 3 months, then that's fine with me.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine Mora lasting on his feet in that fight. I mean, you'd think that Golovkin just physically be able to just overwhelm him. I mean, he's probably the bigger man. Mora might be taller than him, but, you know, I think it could have some kind of bizarre interest in watching Mora just try to completely negate whatever Golovkin's doing without, you know, even attempting any offense of his own, which is probably what he would do.
Well, maybe like 2007 or so, and there might be a couple listeners who are listening right now that remember this, but I don't know if you guys remember, but it was right when Antonio Margarito was kind of, you know, hot, I guess, and a lot of people were calling for Floyd Mayweather to fight him. On Max Boxing, they did this kind of little, like, web video series called Gym Wars, and one of them was Antonio Margarito versus Sergio Mora, and I thought that it wasn't like a bad pairing for sparring by any means, but at one point Antonio Margarito literally just knocked the shit out of Sergio Mora, and his headgear went flying like 15 feet. You know, if that's any indication, and it probably isn't because it's just sparring, but still, he probably wouldn't last.
Well, yeah, I mean, he lost 2 fights to Brian Vera, so. You know,
yeah, that's another good indication.
Vera is the number one challenger for Chavez's, I guess Chavez doesn't have a belt. Well, WBC interim or whatever.
A diamond or platinum or something.
Well, do you guys think Vera gets stopped by Chavez pretty quickly?
I think that's a fun fight because it's 2 come-forward guys. But
well,
I think Chavez is going to
neck in that fight. People's necks are going to hurt. Vera, when you hit him in the head, his head goes all over the place. He's a tough dude. I like him, but that's going to go poorly.
Yeah, he gets hit a lot. And, I mean, you know, he's a guy that I like to, you know, support. And, you know, he seems like a good guy. And he's kind of a gritty fighter. But I think that at this point we've seen that Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. has moved forward and improved and become a better fighter, you know, than what he was even just a handful of years ago. So I don't think that fight is super competitive myself. But I guess we'll see.
Well, this is another thing that sucks about boxing is a guy like Chavez finally does something interesting and compelling in that 12th round against Martinez, you know, that finally maybe gives us some reason to want to watch him going forward. And whether it's like the marijuana suspension or whatever it was, you know, he's out of the ring for a year, and his next fight back, he comes back and he's fighting Brian Vera.
Yeah.
You have guys
and
fight
I wonder
once
about him
a year,
too.
You know.
Like, how long is he going to be a middleweight? How long can we? Because you guys were talking about, like, Chavez Golovkin would be awesome, you know? And Chavez, I'm sure, wants the rematch with Martinez. But how long can he possibly make 160?
You know, if Chavez is crazy enough to take that fight, I mean, he can always tell Golovkin to come up to 164 or wherever he wants.
Yeah.
Because he's going to be able to dictate all the terms on that.
Or you can take it. They can fight in Texas where the drug tests don't get collected or administered or whatever, and you can take the other diuretics you want.
He can do the fight on the terrace of his right next to his swimming pool if he wants.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, well, I embraced the stoner lifestyle when I was like 16 years old, and I didn't last long as a middleweight either. So he'd probably not.
You mean 31 years old?
Weight a whole lot more. No comment. I have to keep my reputation decent in this town.
Yeah, no, I think Chavez is interesting. Like, will he go back to middleweight? I don't know. I mean, I think the guy's a pretty decent sized super middleweight. If he's coming in the ring at 182 or 183, so. He's fighting the Vera fights at a catch weight, isn't it? 164, maybe. So he may never go back to middleweight.
Yeah, I mean, in the kind of draw that he is, and the kind of payday he represents, he you know, can dictate all the terms. He might vision for a little bit.
Well, I love it. I don't know if you guys read the interview that he did a couple days ago with Boxing Scene, but you know, he. Hearing the guy talk, I mean, he's just like, I want Golovkin, I want the Martinez rematch, I want Andre Ward, I want to fight the best fighters. And I actually believe it. You know, I think he's got that. This is a guy who doesn't need to be a professional boxer.
That's right.
No, I believe him, and he's made a good deal of money, and he seems like the type of guy that will, at least even just looking at his record, he looks like the type of guy that would take on just about anybody, and I don't really think he fears anyone. You know, and maybe that's what having a really good chin does to a fighter, but still, you know, to me, I agree. I think that those are the type of fights that if he could, he'd take them, all of them.
Yeah, and what's great is, you know, he's really going to give himself a chance to be great. We know we all doubt him, but if he follows this path, he's gonna make those fights where he can be great, or he's gonna let somebody like Andre Ward or Golovkin, you know, kind of make their name off of him because he's so popular and he's going to give them their biggest exposure. You know, and Martinez's stock rose after he fought Chavez. And, you know, I think Alex was saying, yeah, Chavez definitely was the A-side and brought all those pay-per-views, but I don't think they're getting that many pay-per-views unless he's fighting an elite fighter like Martinez. I mean, everybody knew what that threat was, you know. So I like the guy, man. I think if Chavez is going to move forward and take those huge fights in those divisions. I mean, it's becoming one of the most interesting landscapes in boxing, that 160 to 168.
Yeah, he's a guy who can endure a loss and shouldn't be afraid to take one. Unlike a lot of guys who are so scared to lose one time because what that means back to whatever they just got out of, because they, you know, maybe they got onto a network through connections, whatever. I mean, Chavez has maybe the greatest connection of all, through his dad, but he's kind of earned his spot now, and he can fight Andre Ward and lose, and he will still be a bigger draw than Andre Ward, and he can fight Martinez and lose the rematch. You know, I don't see how that hurts him in any way. So, you know, he's just in a really, I love that he's in a position to do that, and it doesn't seem like that's, you know, he's afraid to. Like, he can lose, and so whatever, I need to fight the best guys out there and see if I win, and come what may.
Right, and what did you guys think about, you know, after Martinez-Chavez, there was kind of like two camps on this, and one side was basically saying, look, Martinez, like, wiped him out. I mean, he won every 11 rounds. Like, he completely beat his ass, gave him a boxing clinic. Like, there's no reason for a rematch, and just kind of totally discounted what happened in the 12th round. But, I mean, I'm kind of on the side of, like, you know, he endured a horrific beating and had the, you know, stamina and the heart and just to give himself a chance to do what he did in the 12th round and showed that he could, you know, he did have the power to hurt Sergio Martinez, who, you know, Martinez has been down in so many fights, but he'd never been hurt like that. And, you know, he really did show something in that last round of that fight. And I you know, I think, my biggest hesitancy toward endorsing that rematch is not being sure about Martinez's condition anymore, because I'm concerned that he's basically kind of damaged goods on his way out of the sport. But, you know,
I think
Chavez's stock rose incredibly from that fight.
The 12th round of that fight kind of, I guess you could justify a rematch out of the 12th round of that fight. And like you said, the fact that Martinez was walking a tightrope the entire time. And then the Murray fight, the way Sergio looked, I mean, that if you were looking to sell the rematch between Chavez and Martinez as something more competitive than the first one turned out, I think you kind of got the ammunition you needed. Because I don't know that Martinez left the Chavez fight able to do that again. And the Murray fight kind of proved that.
I think Chavez is an amazing testament to the power of genetics, right? Because if you look at the punches...
Yeah, not the hard work, the genetics.
He took an insane number of punches in that fight. Like, really hard Martinez punches that had knocked out a whole lot of other people. And he just kept coming like a maniac. He didn't swell. He didn't look bad. And by all rights, he was... We saw him in his freaking pajamas eating cereal in the middle of the night. He was massive, so he was probably dehydrated. He had every right to go down and to swell up, but he just did not. And the only thing I can put that down to is the crazy Julio Cesar Chavez genetics. And that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, I think that as far as Chavez, or Martinez Chavez, that is, I thought that the 12th round was compelling enough to maybe merit a rematch, and especially when considering how well the fight seemed to do and how hyped up people were at the end of the fight. You know, the first 9 through 11 rounds or so, you know, they were not very competitive, and Chavez was getting dinged around quite a bit. His face looked like shit after the fight. But at the same time, that 12th round was, you know, that was round of the year type of stuff because of everything that had happened before it. So, you know, I think that it's probably unlikely that we'll see the rematch if Martinez is operating on the type of schedule that he's operating on, where he's not really going to fight in 2013 at all. And so if he does, you know, come back in next March or May or whatever, they're probably going to be fairly selective about who the opponent's going to be, and I don't know that it's going to be Chavez Jr. again. But as far as should that fight get a rematch, you know, I think it's kind of borderline, but I'd like to see it.
Well, let me throw this out there at you guys, and maybe I'll get crucified for it. But I think that just stylistically and based on size, I think Martinez would actually be more competitive against Mayweather than he would against guys like Golovkin and Chavez. Just based on where Martinez is at with his like physicality and being able to take punches now, you know, I see that as, and I think from Floyd's perspective, I think that's something that he might look at as a winnable fight, because he's seen the Martin Murray fight, he's seen the Chavez fight, he knows that Sergio's declining. I just think that I think if Martinez goes in there against Golovkin or even Chavez, I mean, I have a hard time seeing him going the distance in those fights now if Martin Murray was able to do what he did. And you just can't believe that like knee surgery is going to cure all of Sergio's problems. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with that he's just, you know, taken a lot of punishment over the last few years.
Hold on a sec, because Jimmy, I think, has to go ahead and get out of here.
Oh, sorry.
But I just wanted to thank him for coming on the show and, you know, dropping a couple of nice Golovkin, you know, phallic jokes and whatnot. And thanks again. Please, everybody who is not already a fan of Jimmy Tobin, see him on Twitter at @jet79 or read his work at cruelestsport.com. It's really good stuff. Jimmy, thanks for coming on once again, man.
Thanks very much, guys.
Thanks,
I'll
Jimmy.
Talk to you soon.
Hey, Jimmy.
Thanks. Take care.
Best writer in the history of boxing.
Love it.
Hauser's protege.
All right, Ben.
So do you guys have anything to offer
great
on that one?
Great writer.
Oh, yeah, he's a great writer.
I'll quickly ask if either of you guys had seen the undercard on Friday night fights, Teixeira versus, was it Willis?
Yeah,
yes.
That's what we were going to talk about that.
There we go.
Maybe we should just move right along.
Well, touching on what you were saying right before Jimmy left, I think that Martinez had actually gotten into boxing because he had knee issues. He was doing cycling, like, competitively, and then, well, cycling as in bicycling, not cycling steroids, although that's a different discussion. But he was doing cycling and I think injured both of his knees or something like that and got into boxing because of that. And like I said earlier, I've had knee injuries, and they are a son of a bitch to come back from at all. You know, come back from just as, you know, a normal everyday person, much less a fighter. So I don't know, you know, how much surgery or anything like that is going to help them.
Well, and his age too, you know. But I guess
yeah,
I don't know.
That too.
my point was, you know, if you look at the fights out there for Martinez now, and he's 39 years old, whatever, you know, he's obviously, at this point, he's just going to look for a big fight or two and then probably retire, you know, and you know, I just think I think he's got to be on Mayweather's radar now because he's looked so vulnerable, and I think Floyd does care about accomplishment, and he knows that that's a big fight that he could sell because he's going up to middleweight and fighting the legit champion. And I think if you look at those fights, you know, the other big ones, maybe a Golovkin whose profile keeps rising, and, you know, obviously the Chavez rematch, I think the Mayweather is probably the safest fight for Sergio as far as, like, taking the least damage, you know, and actually – because I think in that fight stylistically, you know, against either of the two bigger guys and the big puncher and Golovkin, Sergio is just immediately going to be put on the defensive, and he's going to have to be on his legs the entire fight, moving around the ring and doing the similar things to what he's done in the past. And with the kind of the physical deterioration that we've seen, I just think against Floyd, who's going to kind of stand in there and not give him that same kind of, like, aggression and coming forward, I think Sergio would be able to at least kind of hold his own more and be able to kind of focus more on his offense, you know. But I think Mayweather-Sergio still kind of is a fascinating fight, and I think that there's a lot on the line, you know, as far as legacies there. Just, you know, anytime you're dealing with, like, the welterweight champ, the best welterweight, going up to fight the best, you know, the reigning middleweight champ. I mean, that's those are fights that have happened so many times in history and usually have ended up being pretty memorable and good. So, I mean, I think if Floyd's so inclined, I mean, obviously that's the biggest money fight, too, for him. But I just think that that's, you know, he's got to just hang around and hope that somebody, you know, hope that that happens. Because I don't think going in against these bruisers at middleweight is a smart idea for him anymore.
No, probably not. But bring us into the undercard of Friday fights.
Well, as Alex mentioned, Patrick Teixeira got a unanimous decision over Marcus Willis. Now, Teixeira is from Brazil. He's been known to be kind of a big puncher. I'm not sure if I've heard of him before. I may have seen him if he's been on ESPN before. And I actually could not watch Friday night fights because I had a big thing going on Friday. But what you guys fill me in. What did I miss? Is Teixeira. The only thing I noticed about this is I noticed Teixeira had a really high knockout percentage going in, and Marcus Willis had been stopped a couple times before by some other prospects. And obviously Willis lasted the distance here. So, I mean, is Teixeira somebody that I should get to know?
Yeah, I think it was really fun. It was a pretty fun fight. Like, Teixeira is like he's not your, like, a lot of Brazilian fighters I've seen, I'm sorry if there's any Brazilian listeners out there and they think I'm being a bit harsh here, but most of the Brazilian fighters I've seen have been total cavemen, and Teixeira wasn't. He was a kind of a come-forward southpaw fighter. He looked a little bit like a Mexican fighter in the way that he dug to the body, and yeah, he was fun. I don't think he's a huge puncher because he didn't get Willis out of there, but he definitely hurt him a few times.
Well, you know, Blanco was pretty crafty.
Yeah, yeah. And Popo.
Well, you know, and actually during the broadcast, and since you didn't watch it, James, they had a brief discussion. That would be Teddy Atlas and Todd Grisham, because Todd Grisham was commentating with Teddy for the show. And he actually did a pretty good job, I thought.
Yeah, fill me in on that dynamic there. I heard that those two guys were doing the broadcast, and then you had Rafael and Osuna in the studio.
Yeah, and I thought...
Give me some media critiques here.
I thought that they all did well. You know, I know that a lot of people have varying issues with Dan Rafael. A lot of people have varying issues with Todd Grisham. And, you know, I've kind of put those aside and, you know, just kind of tried to look at their performances to see how they do. And I thought that they all did well. You know, I like Bernardo Osuna myself. You know, Teddy, I could kind of take or leave at this point because he just gets so repetitive. But it was good.
I thought he
had
a horrible night. Like, I actually agree
Teddy?
With you that everyone else did okay, but I think Teddy is off and on, and this was one of Teddy's really off performances. He was, like, sometimes I feel like he's just not talking to the fight. Like, he was saying at points that Teixeira needed to go to the body, like, immediately after he had just gone to the body for a couple of really hard shots. And he's in, you know, got trotting out. He's like, you got to go down to the plumbing. You got to, you know, work on the basement, whatever else. I just so over it.
Yeah, I could really take Teddy or leave him, because I think that he's a guy who has, at his best, a lot of really good insight, and he's good at, like, you know, kind of breaking down the nuances of fights. But at other times, it's just so, like, aside from the preaching, it's just so, like, you know, see that there? You got to go to the body! To the body! Like, it's just so, like, everything is so misplaced with him. Like, he gets loud, and then he gets quiet, and but
I think he was upset because there haven't been any like other outside sporting events for him to make analogies about in the last couple of weeks. Yeah, the NBA Finals is over. He's kind of in between seasons here.
I think he still even worked some in. I can't even remember what they were, but I think he did. But the reason why I brought up the commentating was because Todd Grisham and Teddy Atlas had talked about, you know, Brazilian fighters, and basically the only one they had mentioned was Oscelino Freitas.
Okay.
And, you know, that's not a bad guy to bring up because he's recent and, you know, whatever. And he was in a couple of notable fights. But, you know, I was – I mean, maybe it's just the kind of history guy in me. But to hear guys that are, you know, professionals talk about, like, the great Brazilian fighters and not bring up Eder Jofre is like, whoa, what? And I think I even tweeted that. I was like, come on, you can't talk about, you know, great Brazilian fighters and not bring up a guy who is – potentially one of the best fighters ever. You know, that's it was a little much for me, but you can't get it all. Hello?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, look, I think the sound might cut out for a second, but I mean, as far as Teixeira goes, I didn't think that he looked bad at all. The fight itself was entertaining. When we were talking about Gennady Golovkin earlier, and I was saying that he had such a good sense of distance and how important that is, you look at a lot of other punchers, and Teixeira among them, they smother their power in close so often that it's almost like they have almost no sense of distance. You know, they get that kind of optimal distance, which is usually, you know, for them, if they have long arms, kind of a longer or mid-range. And then once a guy hits the ropes or, you know, at any moment stops, it's like they're punching and their arms are going forward, but their body's going with them, and they just wind up colliding. And so I think that, to me, looked like a bit of an issue for him in the fight and probably why his power didn't show.
Yeah, and there were a few headbutts in that fight, too.
Yeah, which was also a result, I thought, of them just kind of coming together.
Yeah. You know what I really did like about that, and I noticed that ESPN, the production crew, does such a good job of miking up the ring compared to the other networks. When you listen to the Friday Night Fights broadcast, it just sounds so much better. Every punch sounds so much meatier. I really enjoy it compared to listening to Showtime or HBO.
I think that's just because the arenas are usually empty.
Well, yeah, they're probably playing to smaller crowds for sure, but you know, I think it might also have something to do with HBO and Showtime, you know, feeling like the audience should hear the commentators and stuff like that, which is, I think, what we were talking about earlier, too, that sometimes they can shut up a little bit.
Lampley demands his voice to be at a certain volume relative to the, you know, crowd noise.
I wouldn't be surprised. But also, I guess, before we got into a whole lot of other stuff, and we're not super short on time. We still got like 40 minutes left, but I wanted to also bring up what I thought was a pretty good fight over the weekend. It was on Sky Sports. I think that it kind of slipped under the radar of a lot of American fans just because it wasn't an American fight. And I know that it's tough to keep up with overseas fights for a lot of American fight fans, but Anthony Crolla, I'm not sure actually how it's pronounced because I've heard it a couple different ways, but he earned a majority decision over Gavin Reese, who we just saw not too long ago lose to Adrian Broner. And it was a good fight. It was kind of a back-and-forth fight. Anthony Croia was, you know, I thought set a very good distance for much of the fight. Gavin Reese is kind of a wily guy in there and can get close and throw a lot of punches. Well, he doesn't really have a choice since he's about 3 foot tall. But it was a fun fight, and I think that, James, you said you hadn't seen it, but Alex, you said you had. So
yeah, I caught up with that.
Yeah.
You know what annoyed me about that? The British commentators were riding Crawler's dick all night, and Gavin Reese did a lot of good work, especially in the early half of that fight, that they just ignored. Did you agree?
I do agree, because I heard the Sky team, and it was, I mean, I think that they liked the story of Crawley doing better, more than they liked the story of Reese doing fairly well. I thought it was a pretty close fight myself. I thought that Reese did enough early on in maybe like the first five or six rounds that it was close, but the scoring was close too, so I didn't have an issue with the decision, per se, but, the commentating was a little skewed.
No, I didn't have an issue with the decision either. And, no, Crawler, Crawler's good. How do you reckon Crawler rates in terms of, you know, lightweights in the world? I don't think he's cracking the top 10 yet, personally. But he does have a good jab, and, you know, he's got an upside.
Go ahead, James.
I don't have much to add. I mean, I don't know. I don't think of Crawler as really a top 10. No. I don't think of him as a top 10 guy myself, but maybe I'm not familiar enough with him. I mean, I'd heard of him a couple of years ago. He was going to come in and fight Eric, or he was rumored to fight Eric Morales on the, I think, Mayweather-Ortiz pay-per-view before Morales ended up fighting Pablo Cano. And then, what struck me was Crawler was on the undercard there fighting against a pretty middling kind of a journeyman type and ended up fighting like a 6-round draw. I don't know. I mean, from, you know, without knowing a whole lot, I've always thought of him as kind of just like a domestic level fighter who probably wouldn't be cracking any world rankings.
No, I agree.
But, you know, I mean, Reese is a tough enough dude, I guess. I mean, he did what he did against Broner, and, beating Reese is, I guess, counts for something.
Yeah, and he was able to lay his hands on Broner a little bit. The problem was just that he didn't have the power to do much.
He was just so outsized in that fight.
Yeah, and
I mean,
it just didn't look right. But I will say that I do think that that's one of those fights where, you know, it's fair to say that Broner probably didn't have a whole lot of worry about getting hit, but he did get hit. And so that I think that that's one of those types of fights that kind of lessens the myth of Broner's defense.
But, you know,
in his
defense, you're not usually not going to be fighting a guy 8 inches shorter than you. So, you're getting hit with punches from different angles.
No, that's very true. As far as Crawler goes, apologize if I'm pronouncing that incorrectly, but as far as
just alternate every time you say it.
No, okay, that's fine. I'll switch it up.
I think it's pronounced
Weistow. Please, both audiences. Basically, I know that they've been talking about him taking on Ricky Burns, but I think that Ricky Burns needs to concentrate on Ray Beltran, because that's a fight that he shouldn't be looking past. Even though I know we've talked about Beltran before, and I don't think that any of us thinks that he's anything super special in terms of world-class talent. He's a hard worker, and, he fights in a fairly gritty way himself. So I wouldn't be looking past that fight if there were Ricky Burns. If he does win that fight, then I think that Crawler versus Burns is a good domestic, pairing.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yep.
No, I rate that. I was just thinking, it's interesting, isn't it, when you think about these tall fighters and these short fighters, and I wonder how much of their stature makes their personality in the ring, you know what I mean? Like talking about Reese, right? He's like 5 foot nothing, and he's an absolute little scrapper. And imagine how good he would be if he had an extra 6 inches on him. I mean, it would totally change. Like, if he could do everything that he did and have
right.
the height, he'd be a monster.
But then you have to proportionalize his weight, and then he would be like a light heavyweight. So then he probably wouldn't be that good.
That's true.
But I see your point. I mean, yeah, you're right.
And then you have guys like Weisthausen, who's 6'4" and is way bigger than everyone bigger than everyone else in the ring, and he just seems kind of like he's just kind of meh. He doesn't. Or again, you could say the same thing about Willie Nelson. Like Willie Nelson just like had not much going on, and I wonder how much of that comes from I wonder if the short man syndrome applies to short boxers in big weight division.
Well, I think that you know, there's some fighters who just really maximize all of their physical ability, and then there's other guys who are just really athletic specimens who just don't seem to have, you know, even if they have skill, they just, there's things missing that, you know, they can't, they kind of, you know, they're not utilizing all of their assets to become the best fighter that they can be. You know, and somebody like Reese certainly is.
Yeah.
And it speaks to the mindset of the fighter, too. You know, some guys, you know, legitimately do just want to get in there and bang. You know, a guy like even, you know, the late Chico Corrales, who was a big 130-pounder, a pretty big lightweight, you know, but he was still banging inside with the vast majority of the guys that he was fighting. The only time I can really think of that he, you know, got a jab working or, you know, was very conscious of his height was against Yoel Casamayor in the second fight because, you know, because of what happened the first time where he got his lip basically torn off, you know. So I think that it speaks also to the mindset of the fighter as well.
Well, and I look at, you know, I don't want to rag on him too hard, but I look at somebody like Chad Dawson, who just, to me, has this, like, every physical gift you could want to be a really great fighter at that weight division. And, you know, he's had a good run, and, you know, eventually he did, I guess, become kind of the lineal light heavyweight champion by beating Hopkins. But, you know, you still feel like, you know, if you give him some of the instincts that some other fighters have, you know, he really had the physical ability to be great. And I think he probably fell short of that.
You put Chad Dawson with a style like, for example, Michael Spinks, who was a guy who liked to throw a lot of punches. You know, I think that you make Chad Dawson more active in simply just throwing more punches, and he's a much more effective fighter. But that's been the knock on him for a handful of years now already, that he's just, he fights like sedated half the time. Almost he doesn't really know what the end game is, like what he needs to do.
He is kind of sedated, yeah. But you know, yeah, it's like he's able to outspar, you know, 95% of the fighters in the world. So he's just kind of content to stay at that one level. But he seems like he's isn't able to kind of make adjustments and really capitalize on the fact that, you know, there's not going to be anyone at 175 coming in there that's got the wingspan and like the hand speed and kind of the physical tools that a guy like Dawson has, but. There's obviously, it's kind of like Alex and I were talking before we even went on the air, and you know, I was basically saying, you know, can you imagine a heavyweight with the physical gifts of like a LeBron James, you know, somebody 6'8", 6'9", 250, and like that agile, that quick. But there's, you know, intangibles to fighting that you just don't know. How does a guy take a punch? How does a guy respond to adversity? You know, how does a guy respond when he's hurt? And, you know, these are things that you can't quantify just by, you know, measuring your you know, arm length and things like that.
Yeah, and it's a much more complicated game, and I don't mean to say that it's more difficult than basketball or baseball or golf or anything like that. You know, I've played these sports, and they're very difficult, but there are just things about boxing that are unique where these physical gifts, you know, that's all they are. They don't earn you wins necessarily. Just being a certain height doesn't make you a great heavyweight. Just having a certain type of reach doesn't make you a great outside fighter, you know.
Right, but most great fighter, like transcendent fighters, were also great athletes. I mean, there's obviously exceptions to that, but, you know, guys like Roy Jones Jr., even Floyd Mayweather, Manny Pacquiao, I mean, just unbelievable, like, quickness and coordination and athletic gifts. And, you know, so, and there's guys who just are incredibly skilled, and maybe they're not, you know, quote, great athletes, but for the most part, you know, it's a combination of both. At the highest level,
it's just that eventually you get taken to you. If you fight for long enough, you'll get taken to a point by someone where you have to make a mental decision to continue, and whether you do or not, and how you go about it is going to determine where you end up. You know, whether you win or lose, which is something that you can't always say about basketball or football or baseball. You know, you can probably play soccer or basketball or football forever and never get to that situation where you have to dig that deep, that far into your reserve.
I don't know if
and
you
speaking,
yeah.
Speaking,
mean, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to relate a quick anecdote that I remember Doug Fisher telling me, you know, probably, I don't know, like 2002 or 2003 or something like that. And I'm pretty sure he's written it too. But after Hopkins Trinidad, which Max Boxing did just an absolute, you know, great job of like kind of chronicling the whole way through, I remember Doug Fisher and I think Steve Kim both saying that they had seen Hopkins doing road work, and that even just watching Hopkins run was like almost painful because he was so like, he just seemed like uncoordinated when he was running. And so he didn't seem like, you know, your quintessential really good athlete. And so, like you said, sometimes it's not just athletic prowess or what you were born with or how tall you are, et cetera. But, you know, there are skills that you have to learn as well to be great when you don't have those type of things. And Hopkins is a guy who is basically the epitome of, you know, the type of fighter who might not have every single physical or athletic tool, but he knows what he's doing in there to make up for that.
Yeah. Or I think another great example is like Roberto Duran, just a physical beast at 135. Obviously, as he got older and that decayed, his skills were enough to make him competitive until he was like 40 against much heavier guys than what he was fighting in his prime.
Exactly. Well, I guess now would be a decent time to start previewing this next week of boxing because there are also a couple little small topics that I wanted to try to ask Alex about before we went.
And this was great because I completely forgot that this fight was this weekend, but a man who I'm going to go ahead and we discussed this maybe last week or the week before, but I'm going to dub him the best American heavyweight at the moment, Tony Thompson, which is interesting because he's, 41 years old?
42?
Yeah.
He's like 42 or something like that.
But, you know, what other American heavyweight has a win like the win that he has over David Price recently? So, you know, Thompson is a he's not a scrub by any means, but in his only losses in the last like 10 years or something were to Vladimir Klitschko. So obviously he's hoping to repeat his fate and just completely send David Price's career reeling. And Price is looking to kind of shake off that first fight as a fluke because it was kind of a weird kind of knockdown, caught him on the ear, seemed like just the perfect spot to kind of mess up his equilibrium for just enough time that, you know, he ended up kind of not being able to make it up or making it up unsteady right at the end of the count, having the fight waved off. What do you guys think here? Do you think that Price was exposed and he's just fragile and this is something that's, you know, going to be a problem for him and he's never going to make it to the highest level? Or do you think Price can shake this off and get back on the right track?
I don't really know what to think anymore after Mitchell Banks. I was certain that Banks was going to pulverize Mitchell in the heavyweight rematch. And I would have said the same, I would have said the opposite here, that David Price was going to take out Thompson.
But I mean, do you think there's a difference between the type of punches that Mitchell got hurt with in that first fight than the one that Price was hurt with?
Yes and no. I think Thompson got very lucky. Like that was, I mean, that was like a weird punch to the behind the ear. And
it was almost to like the back of the head.
Yeah.
It wasn't that far, you know. Like it was like millimeters from like legitimately being to the back of his head. I mean, I'm not calling foul. You know, I'm just saying. You know, I agree that it was. It was kind of a fluky punch. It wasn't like a straight-to-the-jaw, like, knock-flat-out type of punch.
But Price, I think, is always going to have chin issues. He got knocked out by the Italian, Roberto Camarelli, in the amateurs at Beijing. And I just don't... He's at heavyweight, it's a problem. You're always going to run into big punches. And I think that's always going to be something that's a bit of an albatross around his neck. I don't know if Thompson can do it again. What do you think, Patrick?
I'm kind of torn myself, especially with you mentioning Mitchell Banks, too. It's just, I personally, going into the first Tony Thompson fight, I thought that that David Price really did look like a type of guy who could potentially even just like bulk up just a little bit and be a little bit sturdier, go forward and have a good career at heavyweight, you know, maybe not necessarily rule the division or anything, but, you know, with all due respect to Tony Thompson, I don't, you know, think that highly of him in general. the first fight was definitely a good win for him. But, you know, I think that his punching power is probably a little bit overrated. I don't think that he's super skilled. And so when I take that into account and look at the first fight, it kind of worries me for David Price because, you know, I'm worried about what if, it, you know, what if it doesn't, it's the punch that's not to the back of the ear or, you know, I don't know. I think that it's an intriguing fight in that Price could come back and could show a number of things coming out of the second fight if he wins, but I don't know if I'm counting on it.
I think he will win this one. I think that was a fluke, but I think that over the long term, the same thing is going to happen to him eventually.
Probably.
What do you reckon? Especially if he's...
I agree with Alex on that. I think... Yeah, if I had to pick, I expect that Price will probably, you know, redeem himself a little bit. I mean, going into the first fight, I thought Price was going to knock Thompson out. Thompson had just had that pretty lackluster performance against Klitschko, and you know, obviously it's Klitschko. But going into that rematch, you know, I thought Thompson just looked pretty spent when he, against Vladimir Klitschko like last year, and when you know, I just based on what I knew, was thinking that Price would kind of finish the job and blow him away. So I was really surprised by this.
I think everyone was, though.
Yeah.
And Thompson didn't look that great before landing that knockout punch.
No, either. No, he didn't. And it's a little – that's the thing is, like, I guess I'm viewing it a little bit differently. For one thing, I mean, I think we all probably regarded Price higher than we did Seth Mitchell. You know, the other thing was the way that it played out. You know, Mitchell, I mean, Mitchell seemed like he was getting hurt by every punch before he got TKO'd. I mean, it was just, and Banks is not a big puncher. This punch was just in such a weird kind of perfect position to do that kind of damage. And a big guy toppling over like that is, you know, dazed, it's going to be really unlikely for him to get up. So, you know, you could kind of write it off and say, okay, that was just, you know, a weird kind of perfect storm and Price can recover from it. And my instinct's like, he's probably is going to get past this fight. But, you know, it does have to kind of concern you going forward about anointing him as a really great fighter, because if you're a heavyweight and you're moving up in the ranks, you're going to fight big punchers and guys who can, you know, guys who are a lot better than Tony Thompson. I mean, as you know, good of a career as he's had. And like I said, I mean, I was kind of half joking, but there really is a case that Thompson might be the best American heavyweight if you're going solely off of achievement. So, yeah, I mean, I think that we've got to see, you know, we've got to see what happens on Saturday, and then moving forward, you know, you probably want to, you know, have a little bit of caution about being too optimistic about Price's career. But fighters have bounced back from stuff like this before, so, you know, it's too early to say.
You know what would be fun?
I agree.
Pride, what's that? Fury.
Oh, yeah, it'd be great. I mean, it's much better for boxing if Price wins this fight. And really, if he looks spectacular and knocks out Tony Thompson, I mean, that's the best case, because there are so many fun fights on the British level against a guy like Fury. I mean, you want to see the young, you know, heavyweight contenders do well. That's going to be better for the sport. Having a 42-year-old American guy who's already gotten, you know, pretty destroyed when he fought the best fighter in the division, having him keep winning, that's not really going to do much for the future.
I agree. And you know, like, it's basically, well, first of all, Price Fury, you know, I'm not so sure that Tyson Fury gets past David Haye, and supposedly that fight is done for September. I don't know if it really is or not, but that's what I heard late last night and early this morning. But I think that would probably be at least the lead-up to the fight would be pretty funny, and then watching two guys that big go at it.
Yeah, it's like a Conor freak show. Two guys with gigantism, pretty much.
Yeah, and it'd be a great atmosphere,
like,
too.
Like Valuev versus Valuev or something.
Valuev versus
cool.
Sasquatch.
Exactly, Valuev versus Valuev.
A few years ago.
Well, I guess I will move on to Friday night fights of this week. The main event is Eleider Álvarez versus Alan Green. And, you know, even though I think Alan Green is probably being brought in as opponent, and that, you know, his career seemed to take a pretty decent slide especially, you know, for a couple fights span there, he lost a few fights, even though they were against world-class type opponents. I think that it's pretty clear that he's being brought as the opponent here against Alvarez. But not a lot of people know Alvarez. So to those who don't, he was actually a Colombian Olympian in 2008, and he actually won the Pan Am Games in, I think, 2007. So I guess really what this comes down to, this fight on Friday Night Fights, is where is Alvarez as a professional? Because it's fairly clear to me. I remember seeing Alvarez. I've written up a couple of his fights on Friday Night Fights. But, you know, where is Alan Green in his career in comparison? Because we know what he's capable of and what he's not capable of. We've seen Alan Green freeze up in bigger fights. But regardless, that's still Alvarez's biggest opponent. So my question to you guys is, what do you think about Alvarez? You know, is he quality? Is he a type of guy that's going to go get through Alan Green?
It looks good. I like the look of him as a fighter. He's got an educated jab, and he throws like a nice little chopping right.
He jabs a lot.
Yeah, and he doesn't mind mixing it up either, and you win a Pan Am Games gold medal. That's you know, it's not an easy task. He had to beat a Cuban to do it, you know, and that's no easy feat in the amateurs. I think he's got a big upside. And Green is a good test at this point, because Green beats those guys who are below the top level but loses to the good guys. So, you know, I'm as Friday Night Fights main events go, I think it's pretty good. What do you think, James?
Yeah, I think you covered my sentiments there. I mean, Green is just such an enigma. It's hard to say, you know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I've seen Alvarez a couple times. I think he looks like a good prospect. I mean, it looks like a pretty good good kind of crossroads match on paper.
That's exactly what it is. You know, one way or another, you know, barring some type of crazy, weird, or stupid ending, you know, I'm about to, like, genuflect and do the sign of the cross so that doesn't happen or something. But barring that type of outcome, we should learn something, you know, about one guy or the other, if not both. So, you know, it's as far as Friday Night Fights main events goes, I agree with Alex. It's not a bad one.
Yeah, I think it's decent. And also, on the undercard, Alex's favorite fighter, Billy Dibb, is taking on Mike Oliver. So Dibb's got another TV date coming off of the split decision loss against Gradovich in that last fight. And that was actually a pretty decent fight. I mean, a lot of Dibb's fights have been criticized because he's definitely more of a boxer, and some say he has kind of a boring style. You know, I don't know what to make of this. I mean, it seems like an okay undercard. I think Oliver's kind of a talented guy. You know, my clearest memory of him is when he got destroyed by Juan Manuel Lopez in between the two Salido fights. You know, Oliver's a little chinny, but Dibb's not really a big puncher. So, you know, I mean, just based on resume and things, I mean, I would think that Dibb would have enough to get past him. But I was pretty surprised that Gradovich was able to give Dibb as good of a fight as he did. So how do you guys see this playing out? And what did you think also about the Dibb-Gradovich fight? I mean, do you think that – I just thought Dibb looked off all night.
You're his biggest fan, Alex. Come on.
Putting me on the spot here, man. I can't back up Billy Dibb just because he's my countryman. He is a bit of a boring fighter. He should get past Mike Oliver. Like, Mike Oliver, he ain't all that. I feel bad for these guys who outwardly don't seem it's even worse than a guy who, like we were talking about before, who has all the physical attributes but none of the mental attributes. A guy like Chad Dawson. I feel worse for guys like Mike Oliver, who have the mental attributes but none of the physical attributes. He has no power whatsoever, and he's really chinny. But he's not afraid to mix it up. Like, in that Juanma Lopez fight you were talking about, James, like, everyone saw it. He got up in Juanma Lopez's grill, and he landed some what looked like big shots. They just weren't big shots because they were from Mike Oliver. And I got to admire that. It's kind of like that Paulie Malignaggi attitude, like, go down swinging. except Mike Oliver isn't as durable as a Paulie Malignaggi. He's got Paulie Malignaggi's punching power, but none of Paulie Malignaggi's chin. So I think it's going to be a fun fight because I think Mike Oliver will probably make things a bit interesting with Dib. It's not as interesting as Gradovich did because Gradovich just came on like a Mack truck all night. But I think it's going to be, he'll make it kind of fun, and I think Dib is probably going to stop him in the mid to late rounds.
Yeah, that's the way I see it going too.
Yeah, I thought that Gradovich was, I'm not a Gradovich expert by any means, but it seemed to me that he seemed to fight a little bit better than what I had seen from him prior against Dib. But still, I thought that he pretty clearly won. I didn't really think it was worthy of a split decision. Regardless, I think that Billy Dib is also the type of fighter where, you know, we have seen it a couple times before. He can be boring, but also when he's really pressed, he can be somewhat entertaining sometimes. And Mike Oliver is kind of the same type of guy, except for, as Alex said, he couldn't really crack an egg with his punching power. So that's really what it's, I think, going to be a big difference in the fight where, you know, Evgeny Gradovich, or I'm not sure how to pronounce his first name because it's awkward, but I think that he just had more going for him against Billy Dib.
Call him by his nickname, which is the best nickname in all of boxing, the Mexican Russian.
Yeah, and to me, before that fight, Gradovich kind of almost looked like a little Ji-Hoon Kim-ish, where, you know, he looked good and he was fun to watch, but he looked like he was kind of headed for a loss, you know, sooner rather than later. But, Mike Oliver, he's coming into the fight, and I think that he's, number one, the opponent, number two, has a lot of disadvantages going against him. And so I would expect Billy Dib to win. I just hope that it's entertaining. Like, literally, I hope it's entertaining.
Plus, Mike Oliver
really
hasn't fought that Wanmar Lopez loss, which is...
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah,
nearly 2 years ago now. That's not
for almost 2 years.
Yeah.
And 50 Cent really needs to do a better job bribing the judges this time.
Yeah, that was a little bit painful to watch with him, ringside and kind of like, But, you know, whatever. As far as Friday Night Fights cards, as we said earlier, I don't think it's bad. It's got enough big name type of attraction that it should kind of draw some viewers in, I guess. And hopefully it winds up being entertaining because at the end of the day, that's really 90% of what I care about.
Yeah, with Alan Green's
before,
fan base tuning in, I mean, it'll get at least 10,000 people watching live.
Oh, he could he could totally sell out a high school gym in South Carolina. I mean, don't get me wrong.
You know what the sad
before
thing is?
Before we go, though? What? Go ahead.
I can't substantiate this, but a lot of these fights, these terrible fights with Aussie fighters, I mean, sorry, it's not a terrible fight, but it's not a big fight. A lot of these fights with Aussie fighters that are on regular TV in America end up as pay-per-views in Australia, and people pay $50.
I've heard that.
Anthony Mundine or Billy Dib fight Bronco McCart or Mike Oliver.
Jeez.
I've heard that.
Not many people.
I've heard that they charge for every Mundine fight down there.
Yep. Anthony Mundine has never had a fight that's not on pay-per-view.
That's
Isn't
crazy.
That,
that is crazy.
Let that sink in for a second.
Yeah, Well, before we go, I actually wanted to get into the subject just because it's a big subject, I guess, in boxing right now, and a lot of people are tilting and whirling all over about it. Lucas Matisse and Danny Garcia have been, supposedly in kind of preliminary talks to make a fight between them. Well, I'll just put it out. It's one of the best fights in boxing, I think, or one of the biggest fights in boxing, in a very deep division between two guys who are somewhat hot right now. And so in the last couple of days, the development seems to be that Lucas Matisse is coming out to this media outlet and that saying he wants the fight. They've accepted such and such terms, and they're just waiting on Danny Garcia. So seriously, though, and we've talked about this in recent weeks, but now it seems to kind of just be escalating. Is Danny Garcia ducking Lucas Matisse?
Alex, you want to take this?
Well, I
don't want to say it first.
I think I'm going to try and play the cool head on this one and say we have to actually wait until Garcia signs or doesn't sign. But it's not looking great. At the same time, maybe there's some small issue there that we haven't heard about. There's something going on. I know everyone wants to you know, give Danny Garcia a kick here, but I think we need to wait a little bit longer, give it a couple more days and see what happens.
Yeah, that's a good perspective. But, you know, also, I mean, you know, Garcia's a really good fighter. It's not like he's necessarily going to, you know, just going to befall the same fate that happened to Lamont Peterson. I mean, Garcia is a really good young fighter. I don't really blame him here because, you know, if you're Danny Garcia and Golden Boy says, you know, hey, we'll give you $2 million to fight Lucas Matisse, or we'll give you $1.5 million to rematch Zab Judah. You know, you just say, okay, I'll take the $1.5 million to rematch Zab Judah, and then I'll fight Matisse. You know, I mean, you can't really blame the individual guy. I mean, yeah, okay, if he wanted it to happen, he could make it happen. That's true. But, you know, nobody, if it doesn't happen, there's obviously other entities involved that didn't force it to happen that could have, namely Golden Boy, Showtime. So, you know, I think duck is always a strong word. I mean, for, you know, it's tough to say that because this fight really didn't become all that legitimate until, I mean, yeah, we all would have watched it a year ago and would have liked it. But, you know, it really got super hot after what Matisse did to Peterson. So, and that was just a couple months ago. So, you know, it's tough, man, because if, you know, like they keep talking about the making a rematch with Zab Judah, which to me is just completely pointless. I didn't want to see the first fight. I don't really care that Judah was able to come back and win a couple rounds in the second, and you know, in that fight. I didn't think that anything about that necessitated a rematch. And if that's the direction that they go, I mean, I place most of the blame on the promoter, because if you're Garcia and you're going to get a nice payday to take that fight rather than fight the, you know, absolute killer that is Lucas Matisse, it just makes sense to do that, you know? If he had no other option. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I agree. From a business perspective, and if you're a manager who basically, your job is looking out for your fighter, trying to get them paid the best that you can and minimize, you know, damage, minimize risk, then that's a smart rematch to make. And Zab Judah still is a name. But, you know, with the kind of, like, you know, touching on what you said a minute ago, there's really just no reason not to make the fight. They're both advised, quote unquote, by Al Haymon. They're both with Golden Boy. They're both in a position where, you know, like, you know, and I'm sorry for even bringing them up, but the sanctioning bodies seem to be saying, make the fight. It's, to me, it's just like, well, now's the time. Matisse just destroyed Peterson not long ago. Garcia, you know, I thought that the Judah win was not very contentious. Zab won a couple rounds late and surprised everybody by hurting Danny Garcia, but it wasn't like a close fight. So I'm not really interested in seeing that rematch. If Danny Garcia is healthy and he can move forward and so is Matisse, then I'd rather see this sorted out sooner rather than later.
Well, the troubling thing is that either they're trying to use it as some kind of a bargaining chip, and we can hope for that, or somebody is really putting the idea in the Garcia camp's, you know, heads that, hey, this Judah rematch is a viable alternative too, and we could do that. And that somebody has to be their promoter, Golden Boy Promotions.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all in the same place that we really want to see this fight first, right?
Like, of course.
We all really want to see this fight. It's just there's like, and there are no impediments to this fight happening. There's no promoter beef. There's no different managers or whatever. It's
yeah.
just that potentially there's, like you said, James, this thing where a manager thinks, what's best for my fighter? Is it facing Lucas Matisse now, or is it facing Zab Judah now? They can probably sell out the Barclays Center again.
And the thing is, you know, unless somehow, like, magically overnight the Cold War dissipates, and then all of a sudden, you know, they could fight against, like, a Marquez Bradley or Alvarado or one of those guys, there's no other opponents for them at 140 now. I mean, Garcia, I guess, could, like, rematch Khan, although I think Khan's out of the division. But, you know, they have no one but each other. They've beaten everyone else. They're the top two guys in the division. It has to happen.
Period. And we have about 45 seconds left on the show. So, in any event, I would like to thank everybody who tuned in to listen. I saw some people tweeting along and asking questions and stuff like that, and we really appreciate everybody listening. And also, of course, first and foremost, I would like to, well, second and foremost, I guess, would like to thank Alex McClintock, my buddy from Queensberry Rules, coming on, and Jimmy Tobin from Crueless Sport. So Queensberry Rules, Crueless Sport, and James Foley from Bad Left Hook. Thank you, everybody, so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks, guys.
See you, guys.
All right, take it easy.